Welcome underground. The sound you're listening to right now, the Echoes Underground jingle, if you will, is me playing a shaman drum. Shamanism as a concept has been lurking in the background of our podcast since day one. Today, we bring it out into the open. We take a proper look at it. Enjoy.
So I'm very excited. I'm very excited to hear about shamanism. Hit me with shamanism.
Yeah. I've been reading a weird amount about shamanism. And I'll see if I had any interesting thoughts as a result.
Okay. Well, I think that shamanism comes into quite a lot of what we talk about and so on. So I think, you know, I'm well up for this, listener. If my voice doesn't convey adequately the excitement I feel, then that's on me, because this has been a long time coming. Shamanism.
It has been. I mean, I look at the shelf to my left and there's Sky Shamans in Mongolia, The Way of the Shaman, Shamanism, the Timeless Religion, The Quest for the Shaman, The Wizard of the Upper Amazon, etc.
Yeah, you get the picture. I think you're painting a picture. And the introductory jingle to this very podcast is a shamanic drum.
That is my shaman drum, yeah.
Yeah.
I like it very much.
It's a sort of a big shallow thing that you hold in a hand, a bit like a shield, isn't it? And then you sort of tap it on it, you know.
Exactly. It's a 24-inch frame drum with a cow leather, cowhide skin.
He says it's wood. He says it's cowhide. I have my suspicions.
It's the hide of my vanquished enemy.
Yeah, that's my suspicion.
But of course, calling it a shaman drum, you're immediately trying to define shamanism, because it's kind of modeled on the sort of Siberian or Mongolian, the drums that those shamans use.
Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, you can see this is going to be a fraught conversation.
Defining shamanism turns out to be one of those difficult things.
Well, why don't you give us the naive, because I actually don't really know that much about shamanism. I have a vague idea. From having read sort of a bit about comparative mythology and comparative religion and stuff. So, I mean, I back myself to know a little bit more than your man on the Clapham Man on the Bus, but why don't you give us the naive definition? You know, what do losers think shamans are?
Yeah, well, I mean, the real losers are the ones who say, oh, you can't actually define shamanism because it's different in each culture and you're being colonialist by even trying to put them all in a group and giving it an ism. That's quite offensive, actually, and ignores the diversity of human experience. So, there is an argument because it is quite different everywhere, but it's also not very useful. I think it's nice to have a sort of box to put a broad category of things into, whilst acknowledging that it's not the whole picture, and that a shaman in Indonesia is going to be very different to a shaman in Peru. So on the one hand, you have that. And on the other, you have like really, really detailed definitions. Michael Harner, who was an anthropologist, who then became the kind of leading light of neo-shamanism and invented a technique called core shamanism. He had this definition involving like soul journeys and world trees and things like that turned out to exclude the Siberian tribe, the Tunguskic people. From whom the word shaman comes.
It's a bit embarrassing. Embarrassing that I think that's the model that I'm most familiar with. Those all sort of ring a bell with me, so oh dear.
Well, that is the sort of neo-shamanism, where you're going on a soul journey to the beat of a drum and the world's divided into three realms. You've got the upper realm and the lower realm and the kind of the plane we live on day to day, and you get there via the world tree and all that. But yeah, it's a bit like those definitions of Henge that exclude Stonehenge.
I think that maybe I'm wrong here. Maybe I'm underestimating our listeners massively. But if I am, it's only because of where I am myself. Perhaps we could wind it back even further. Like, we're already assuming quite a lot of knowledge here when talking about these kind of definitions of shamanism. Like, if you had to just give it a pretty, like, really, like, broad brush colors, like what is a shaman and what is shamanism, like what is it? Okay. What are we talking about?
I mean, the cleanest definition I found from a recent book called Shamanism, The Timeless Religion by Manveer Singh, which is the current hype book on shamanism. I think it was only released this year. He boils it down to these are people who enter non-ordinary states. They then engage with unseen realities, and they do this to provide a service to their community, like healing or divination. Mm. So basically, these are specialists. They are service providers within their community whose method of delivering the service is engaging with other worlds whilst being in a non-ordinary state of consciousness.
That works. Yep.
Is that clean enough for you?
That's clean. Yeah, I like it. I like it. It's already... I'm tantalized. This is very interesting.
It seems to develop kind of everywhere. The anthropological theory is that this is how human cultures deal with uncertainty.
Mm.
You don't know whether your crop's going to grow. You don't know whether it's going to rain. You don't know whether your illness is going to pass. And so what you do is you go to someone who looks like they know, who is a specialist in knowing things like this. And they do something that you can't, because they have some abilities that you know, the rank and file don't have. And through this, they give you an answer, and that dispels the uncertainty.
Mm.
And so these specialists arise pretty much universally.
Right.
I mean, there'll be exceptions. I think...
The theory would be that's because there's a structural niche that needs to be fulfilled in more or less every human society, and that structural niche is providing guidance and certainty on things that otherwise cannot be understood.
Exactly. Our brains like patterns, and they tend to sort of, as we discussed in our episode on personification, where we like to subscribe rationality to things that are actually random.
Mm.
And shamans allow us to humor this tendency we all have.
Mm. Okay. And so that's the basic definition then. And there's this neo-shamanistic thing, which is a little bit more detailed, which has been dominant hitherto, about the world tree and the three levels. And, you know, that's a much more specific definition of what a shaman does.
That's extremely specific. And actually, it comes from this book, The Way of the Shaman by Michael Hana, which I read and enjoyed quite a lot. It's almost an instruction manual to becoming a shaman. And it just gives you the sort of easy steps.
I see where this is almost... going. I can see where you got this book.
But I mean, I haven't actually followed the instructions, but they kind of strike you at quite a deep level. It sort of sounds plausible, and I mean, the idea is you need a shaman drum.
Mm.
Actually, I have one here, as it happens.
There it is.
I mean, doesn't it sound lovely? I mean, one of the reasons I bought it is because it sounds so great.
Mm.
And I've managed to sneak it into every song my band has recorded so far without them noticing. If you just need a bit of low-end oomph.
Shout out to the band, Trees on Venus. New Trees album out now. Like and subscribe.
Please do. I'll get my 0.2 pence per play on Spotify.
Hmm.
But yeah, he's very prescriptive. You've got to play it at about 200 beats per minute. So that's like... he recommends that... Actually, have someone else playing the drum for you as you go on your soul journey. Or you play a recording of someone else doing it on YouTube, which is just as valid.
I've got it, just for the listener, I've got an amazing sight in front of me. It's like, you know, it's like a children's TV show where there's a friendly presenter who's sort of banging a drum gently as he talks and looking very pleased with himself.
I'm very pleased with myself.
Yeah. it's very funny.
I get a lot of joy from this.
Yeah.
But you close your eyes,
mm-hmm.
and you imagine yourself going down a hole.
Am I supposed to be doing this now? Is that what we're doing?
I wouldn't. I would invite our listeners to sort of think it through.
Sorry, I'll stop getting in the way. I'll shut up.
Yep. You're recommended to kind of think of holes that are significant to you. I mean, often in your daydreams as a child, you've thought of some hole, some cave, some cavern, some cellar, or even some warp in space. And you go into it. You descend through this hole.
Right.
In your mind, into the lower realm. And just imagine what this lower realm might be like. And you journey through this realm to find your spirit animal.
Okay.
Which it could be anything. It could be a walrus. That's what Manveer Singh's was. My old boss, whenever he took psychedelics, it was always an owl.
Right.
Owls meant a lot to him.
Hey.
He was Mexican. And then you seek advice from this animal. And then you come back up through the hole. And then once you've established this connection with your spirit animal, you can. It's now your helper and guide. And so when you're trying to heal other people or see what's in the future or try and heal yourself, there's a lot of work on yourself in neo-shamanism because it's all about our own feelings. You descend down the hole. You meet your owl, and it will help you.
This is incredible.
I'm just sorry.
Well, okay.
So that's core shamanism.
Yeah. Okay. That's core shamanism. Well, maybe we can release as a sort of an annex to this podcast just a track of you banging that drum and doing a sort of guided meditation. I think that would be an incredible piece of additional media that we can produce, and I for one certainly would love to listen to that and to do the shamanic exercise. I think that would be pretty peak Echoes Underground as I lay there listening to your dulcet tones, discovering my spirit animal.
I'm told reliably that at the very least it gives you much more vivid and imaginative daydreams than you would normally have.
Well, you've spoken before, haven't you, about the idea of drumming and how it sort of physiologically... We talked about it in the audio engineering episode, do you remember?
We did, yeah. The brain's love of patterns and rhythm and it catching some brainwave on the right frequency.
Yeah.
They're always very specific about that frequency. I'm not sure I got it right. Being a drummer, I always speed up. And you look at a lot of folk music in places that are extremely post-shamanic. Like if you look at, you know, Bulgarian folk music or Turkish or whatever, it's always got that driving rhythm to it. That does kind of get you into a trance state. And of course, yeah, trance music has 138 BPM, but once you get up to psy trance, it gets very fast indeed, and it has a similar effect.
So this is the idea of a trance, isn't it? Which is very core to shamanism, the trance, the shamanic trance.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, you know, even with the boring beige definition, the first step is getting to a non-ordinary state of consciousness or a shamanic state of consciousness, as Michael Harner calls it. And there are many ways you can do it. You can do it by looking at colourful lights or hearing that repetitive rhythm. You can do it with what's called breath work, which is, you know, breathing in an intentional way. You can do it by dancing. You can do it by starving yourself. So all the kind of early Christian ascetics in the desert, they're starving themselves and putting themselves into a weird state of consciousness. And, of course, psychedelics. These are all tools to try and get your brain out of the ordinary. And I could almost feel it then with the drum, you know.
I certainly was feeling in a non-ordinary state there watching you do that. Yep.
Yeah, I need to try that on a work Zoom call just to establish dominance. And,
Turn your camera off and just start it so that just really quietly. And you just get a little bit louder. So it's sort of just like boiling a frog until everybody's sort of, you know, suddenly without knowing it, having this incredible daydream about, you know, a gecko that's leading them to the light or something.
Yeah, or the company's quarterly results.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, feel it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Be sliding down that graph or hopefully, you know, climbing up it, you know. Okay.
But yeah, there are a couple of ironies with this neo shamanism. One is it's a lot more about your feelings and emotions because it kind of grew out of the 1960s on the West Coast of America. You know, it's very much in touch with your inner self and remains that way. In a way that is not the case in any traditional society. Like, you know, most of the world, and especially, you know, the pre-Christian world, people didn't think about their emotions a lot.
It's a big claim. I know that that's one of your kind of core beliefs about life and history. It's quite a big claim, isn't it? I mean, it's quite hard to verify.
I'm not saying people didn't have emotions, but they didn't, like, talk about them a lot or dwell on them or spend ages agonizing over them. And especially recently, you know, now we have psychiatry or psychoanalysis and that whole...
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, it sounds like you're, it sounds like things... There's before the psychoanalysts and there's after.
And I mean, yeah, a lot of the kind of new shamans read a lot of Jung, a lot of Freud. A lot of Jung in particular, actually. You go into those weird bookshops and it's just full of Jung books.
Yeah. One of the things I find really interesting about the psychoanalysts, a bit of a side note, is that there is definitely a before and after. They're one of those things where... you know, you can really see before and after, and it's almost like you can't help it. Like even if you're aware of it, even if you're aware that that's what's happening, you can't really escape it. Because you know, if I were to decide to become a shaman, I would definitely be doing it in a way that was influenced by the psychoanalyst. I'd definitely be thinking about, you know, my own subconscious, and I'd be thinking of it in those terms. I wouldn't be thinking of it in terms of
archetypes and
I just would be, you know, it would structure the way my mind, you know, worked around it. So definitely really one of those things to. you can't fight it, so you might as well not.
The other weird thing about neo-shamanism is that it's all very structured. I mean, I just talked you through like a recipe, and it's all very controlled, very prescriptive, when actually if you read the accounts of the anthropologists going through like the Amazon or if you read accounts of what Mongolia was like 100 years ago, I recommend Beast Men and Gods for that by Ferdinand Ossendowski. It's absolute carnage, and like a real like non-neo shaman will like neck a liter of vodka, you know, take an enormous amount of tobacco, be absolute carnage. You know, they'll be screaming. The drumming won't be rhythmic like that. It'll be completely random. And there'll be bells and stuff. It'll be like just complete chaos.
So you're saying that it's not a sort of an act of self-improvement or an act of getting in touch with oneself or self-care in, should we say, traditional shamanic episodes. It's much more...
No, I mean, they are service providers. They really get into it, but it not in a subconscious. Well, I mean, there's a whole debate about how much they believe what they're doing, or the extent to which it's an act. And I think modern accounts of shamanism among those cultures that still have it, you know, there is that question: are they being genuine, or are they putting it on?
Is it sort of LARPing the ancestors kind of thing?
Well, but as we discussed on our episode on LARPing for Christmas, like actually LARPing is very powerful, and it's an important part of what shamans do. Like they have to perform otherness. They have to be outside the community, so they have to do things that other people don't do. You get a lot of abstinence from types of food or from sex or things like that. They have part of the role is living in a way that is different from those within your community. And that's part of where your power comes from.
Well, the whole debate of like, well, is this genuine from the perspective of the interior, you know, the subjective interior, versus is it just an external projection? I would say that question is a post psychoanalyst question.
Yeah,
isn't it?
No, I fully agree. Yeah, because it has the same impact either way.
And
in many ways, like a good shaman is one who performs more convincingly, or more fulfills the role of the shaman better. You know, seems what people think a shaman should be.
Yeah,
and that's part of their power, because one of the interesting things about traditional shamanism, let's call it, or indigenous shamanism, whatever, is that it does actually work. Like people do get healed from a shaman, even though there's no mechanism that modern medicine would recognize at work. It's you're kind of putting people in a state where they give themselves permission to get better, or they feel like they're going to get better. It's almost like a placebo. Well, it is a placebo in many ways, and placebos work.
Yeah.
And so you need to be a very convincing conduit for this.
Well, it's like a form of leadership, isn't it? You know, if you're a good leader, you give people belief that they can do something that they wouldn't have otherwise thought they could do, and then they bloody well go and do it, don't they? And it's like spiritual leadership, isn't it? It's like you can, you know, I believe in you. You know, you are going to get better, and so you do.
Yeah. And so, the best shamans are the ones that put on the best display, regardless of whether their interior experience is aligned with their exterior.
I'm just thinking a little bit more around that statement I made, that the idea of picking up on, does the subjective interior of the shaman, you know, align, match up with, is it true to the act that they're putting on? You know, the difference between the internal reality and the outward action, is that really something that is only post, you know, late 19th century or post early 20th century? I'm just thinking back to the Iliad, where Achilles says to, I think it's to Odysseus, that he hates, like, the gates of hell, the man who says one thing while hiding in his heart another. So there clearly is, you know, in the ancients, I mean, that's going all the way back to possibly the Mycenaean times, there clearly is an awareness that one's internal states cannot match up with one's external actions, right? But I think that from my experience of reading the classics and, you know, looking at ancient peoples, it's much more concerned with the idea of words, right? So it's about speaking one thing and then thinking another. They're very, very kind of attuned to that. But there's no, I can't think of an example in these kind of foundational texts like the Iliad where somebody would pick up on the idea of a false action. Like, your actions are true. You know, your actions are who you are.
I mean, not just ancient Greeks. I mean, look at the Ten Commandments. Like, bear false witness is words. It's not actions.
Yeah.
And it's quite specific on that.
So I think that maybe the idea that actions can be, in a sense, lies, might be the thing that's slightly more modern, I think. And, you know, people will be able to dig out loads of exceptions to this. And, you know, I'm sure there are many, many examples from Enlightenment and Renaissance and blah, 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 where people are picking up on this. I'm not claiming that this is a kind of a nice, dark divide, you know, like pre-Freud and post-Freud. But I do wonder whether it's more of a, you know, as moderns who have gone through the sort of the theories of psychoanalysis and all, everything that moderns have gone through culturally, whether we are more attuned to this and more aware of it than before. I think that might be something that's interesting to think about anthropologically.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, yeah, I think in British culture, like, hypocrisy is really, yeah, do as I say, don't do as I do. But yeah, the problem, like, that is a compelling argument, but the strength of feeling around hypocrisy in British culture feels older. Just can't think of any old books.
We could put a pin in that, but I think it's an interesting idea that actually, if you act other, then actually that is both the way into an altered state of consciousness quite a lot of the time. So if you're starving yourself, or you're dancing about, or you're breathing funny, or, you know, you're eating some questionable substances, and, you know, whatever, that's the way into the altered state of consciousness. And then the altered state of consciousness in turn makes you act increasingly other. And that's what it takes to convince people, because people find actions really convincing. On the whole. And, you know, if you were in
I think that works. It's sort of self-fulfilling.
Yeah, it's self-fulfilling. And if you're in a room or a hut or a tent or whatever, with some chap, and you are really worried about whatever it is, and you know, your crops or your butt or, you know, whatever it might be, and they start going very, very odd and ranting and raving and dancing around or whatever it is. And then they say, well, yeah, the spirits or the ancestors or the forces that be, they say that you're going to be okay. You know, if the performance is striking enough and extreme enough, and yeah, you may well, even if you're somebody from a modern materialist culture, you know, they might be on some level, you're kind of like, oh, well, okay, maybe. Well, I mean, you know, you never know.
I mean, we do have it in a subtle way in modern culture. I mean, if you think about Catholic priests having to be celibate, they're othering themselves, and that gives them a bit of authority. Or all the theatre you get in the medical profession.
Yeah, definitely.
Conscious. Yeah,
totally. I think that one of the interesting things about the modern world is that all of the same mechanisms are at play. You know, what ultimately makes us feel better or heals us or whatever. Okay, there is a, you know, modern medicine does this amazing thing where it can actually sort of chemically alter processes in the body independent of our subjective impressions or our will or whatever. And that's brilliant. And, you know, that's what modern medicine is. But there's a whole load of other stuff that does still happen in the modern world, which is still, you know, using these psychological mechanisms, as we would call them. And actually, one of the distinctive features of modernity is that these things happen in spite of us, rather than with us as comfortable participants.
Yeah. So I'm just reminded of a passage from Shamanism, the Timeless Religion, which is about a doctor who's known as this kind of almost miracle worker. Like he takes on the hardest cases and often succeeds where others have failed. And he says a lot of this is because he dresses very smartly, he wears a bow tie, and he tries very consciously to perform the role of the doctor we all wish we had.
Mm.
And then when he comes in and says, you know, you have something wrong with you and we're going to make it better, people believe. He's able to challenge that really strongly and it works.
I mean, I've suffered from illnesses in my life as we all have. And I remember that, I mean, there was one that stayed with me a long time and sort of really lingered, and I was really struggling to shake it off. And I remember that there was one doctor who I happened to see who she just sort of off the cuff, almost in a sort of, it appeared to be in an almost a reluctant way, says, well, you know, if you do X, you will recover. Yeah, you know, she didn't say it. I don't think she even looked me in the eye. It was more just delivered in a kind of a almost a rueful way, because I think maybe she didn't expect that I would do it. There was something about that it just, because it so clearly didn't seem to be aimed to persuade me of anything. It just seemed to be what she really, really did genuinely believe, that I just latched onto that. And I was like, oh, right. Well, I'll do that then. And, you know, lo and behold, it worked. And, you know, who knows what the mechanism of it working really was, but it did. And yes, it was definitely the belief I latched onto it as something that was certain because of the way that she'd acted. And that was great. that's a good outcome.
There were you confronting uncertainty, not liking it, and then someone gives you a feeling of certainty.
Yeah. And I've often thought as well that, it would be a really good idea in the NHS to have a kind of department of psychological medicine that basically you get drafted in a bit like a sort of SWAT team or the flying squad. When there's a patient who's clearly, you know, who's clearly part of the illness is there, is the sort of the psychological effects around it and their psychological state.
Which I think it is quite a lot of the time, yeah.
You just draft in this kind of SWAT team, and they come in and, they look like very, very, you know, authoritative and reputable people. And they come in and they say, ah, we got the call. We know exactly what your illness is and we know exactly how to fix it. Take these pills, one every day, and you will get better. You know, shake their hand and be like, don't worry, salvation is at hand, glad we could help, and then leave. And, you know, they'd just be sugar pills. But I bet you that would cure a huge number of cases. And that's not me being cynical or thinking that these are bad people or anything. I just think that would work. But it would take quite a But one of the interesting things is that you would never get that set up in the NHS because we'd think it was unethical.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be ethical objections. That's the crazy thing. It would cost almost nothing. It would be really successful.
It would be very effective. Yeah.
And yet people would be like, no, well, because you're deceiving people. But of course,
and what's even funnier is even if people knew that they were being deceived, it would still work.
Yeah.
All this stuff is around placebos. Even when the placebo comes in a big pill saying this is, you know, this pot's full of placebo pills, it still works.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that a shaman is kind of adjacent to doctors and shamans. I guess are not so far apart.
They're all healers. Yeah. But I mean, if you start looking for shaman analogs in modern culture, you get a lot of them. And another classic example, again, Manveer Singh dwells on it quite a lot, is in the world of finance, money managers, hedge fund managers. Like, it's a known fact. We have some friends who back this up, that any money manager and any stock picker will not outperform the market. It's all actually quite random. There have been, all the numbers have been run on this. Like, if you put your money in a fund that spends lots of money on researching and picking the best stocks and going to conferences and all that, you'll most likely do less well than if you put it in an index tracker. Like, the numbers there for all to see. Like even randomness. Like, they once did a competition where they put a cat against, like, you know, the country's top money managers, and the cat made more money. And yet, people still put all their money in the hands of these stock pickers. And these stock pickers make a lot of money because they give you that sense that they know what they're doing. And they live these lives that also other them a bit. You know, they work absurdly long hours, they're hedonistic, it's all very Wolf of Wall Street, and that gives them this aura that means you trust them with your money, even as all the data shows that it's really stupid to give them your money.
I suppose that this is one of the things, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Mm.
This is one of the things that gives me hope of, in the coming AI revolution. And it goes back to that idea, doesn't it? I was explaining to a friend we have who is a fund manager that, why do I think that, why do I have hope that teachers won't be replaced by AI super tutors anytime soon? And I think that because there's a moral element to human, or there's practical and moral element to human to human experience that AI is quite hard for AI to replicate even now. And that is the idea that if an AI tells you to stop getting distracted and get on with your work, it doesn't, it doesn't matter. Like, you can just completely ignore it, or you can type rude words into its interface, or you can, whatever, it doesn't matter. But if there's another human being standing right in front of you and tells you, sternly, stop doing that and get on with your work, you can't help it. It matters more. You value that more. You can't help but give more weight to that unless you're a complete, psychopath.
Yeah.
And actually, a big job of the teacher is just to be there as a sort of a moral structure that creates an environment in which you do something that, fundamentally in that moment you probably don't want to do. I think it's much harder for AI to replicate that. I'm sure it can eventually. I mean, you build a completely artificial environment that, triggers all the same responses. Brilliant. But I think that's a little bit further away, I hope. But anyway, it's a similar thing here, I think, where along with that, what I've just explained, we therefore value the human-to-human experience more. And I don't think it's irrational that we value it, precisely because the human-to-human experience has more of a moral impact, which has a practical positive effect, which is what I've just described. So it's rational to say, well, even though this AI tutor is quicker, it knows more, it can explain things more clearly, and it's cheaper, it's still rational for me to choose the human teacher because they can do this kind of moral structuring that is required when you're trying to get a kid to learn something that an AI can't yet do, right? So it's rational. And I wonder whether you can argue that there's something rational going on with the fund managers, even though all the numbers show that you'll make more money by buying an index fund. What if actually human beings are not interested in just maximizing the money they make? What if actually part of what they're doing when they're going to a fund manager is they're buying an experience? And the experience is the experience of having money and being able to go to someone who is a fund manager and have that experience of them being like, well, you know, what should we invest in? What should we do with this money? You know, we're both, you know, we both know all about money and we're both very important and powerful. And you're very important to me. You know, you with the money, you're very, very important. And, you know, I'll do anything for you. And I'm very fancy and high powered myself. You know, that's intoxicating, isn't it? You've got a guy or a woman sitting across from you and they're wearing a fancy watch in a fancy office with a fancy suit on. And they're saying, you know, so what how should we do? How are we going to pay this? How are we going to, I'm going to work for you. You know, that's intoxicating. Whereas just, you know, buying an index fund, well, so like what? That's nothing. It means nothing to me. Like, yeah, okay, I'm going to get more money, but what's the point of having the money if I can't get someone in a fancy building to work for me? So I think it's still rational. It's just that we're not, I think that, you know, all of these people that look at this sometimes are assuming that we are rational economic actors who just want to maximize money, but we're not. We're human beings.
There are other analogs, though, that are perhaps even more rational. So like the tech CEO, the startup founder, they're normally absolutely bizarre. Yeah, if you look at the big names, you know, the guy who founded Twitter or whatever, they're all like vegans, doing psychedelics all the time, doing these weird mystical retreats, wearing odd clothes, they'll be walking around the office bare feet. Yeah, they'll have unkempt hair like Sam Bankman-Fried. They will often quite deliberately cultivate this image of being other and cultivate an aura of being special. And again, if you're the sort of person who invests in startups, you know, which one are you going to back given no other information? Like, you just have an idea, you got no revenue. You're going to go with the one from a sensible ex-banker who looks like he's all over it. Or are you going to go with the wild-eyed shaman? Quite often, VCs will choose the wild-eyed shaman because he's got aura. You want to be part of that story.
Well, also it could be rational.
Once again, other people can't do.
It could be rational because you're looking for the unicorn, right? The mythical animal that's going to make you a return, not some sensible return of 5%, but it's going to make you a return of like 3,000%. You know, you're looking for you're looking for the magical thing that's going to break the norm. And you're thinking, well, which one of these two people is more likely to be my 3,000 break the norm, something nobody's ever done before return? Is it going to be the guy in the suit or is it going to be the guy, you know, banging a shaman drum? Like, well, you know, the guy in the suit's more likely to get me a nice 5% return. But if I want that 3,000% return, I've got to go for the guy with the drum.
Yeah. The worst thing is it works quite a lot.
I think
because these people, you know, you're not only winning over the investors, you're winning over employees. People want to work for you because you've got that aura and will get them, you know, their massive equity check. And you know, as a salesman, you're very effective because people want to buy your product because it's clearly going to be amazing because,
It's the power of belief again, isn't it? It's the power of belief.
Yeah.
You know, my point, if I'm not overdoing it, is that power of belief is not necessarily irrational. I think it is rational because it has effect. It has material effects in the world. That belief. Okay, pro shaman point.
Yeah, and we go back to our thing about cultivating an aura that we discussed in the meditation on violence episode.
Zanshin.
It's the next level up. So it's not just looking like you're capable and aware. It's also looking like you're visionary.
Change the world. Or you can bend reality.
You know things other people don't.
Yes, you know things other people
sometimes,
don't.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder in my own job whether I ought to be leaning into that a bit more because, again, I do finance and startups. And so a big part of that is trying to forecast the future. You know, sometimes like, well, how much money will we have next year? You know, can we afford to hire 5 more sales guys? You know, and you know, there's obviously no way of knowing. Like, an absurd number of variables that it's impossible to know. But, you know, I go into my altered state of consciousness, which is autism, and then I you know, commune in a higher realm, which is in the spreadsheets, which no one else understands. And then I come out with an answer and I say, yes, we should hire 5 more salespeople. and then everyone's relaxed because I've brought them certainty in an uncertain world.
Yeah. Well, I think you're doing pretty well, but I mean, you actually have a shaman trump, for one thing. You have a very impressive beard. You have a Jedi robe, which you often do the podcast wearing.
I don't do my financial forecast wearing it, though.
I see. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I've been flirting with introducing tarot cards into the financial discussions to kind of guide the conversation.
What you'd have to do is you'd have to disguise them somehow, right? So you'd have to say something along the lines of, I've got this great new piece of tech, right? It's got quantum in it. It's got, you know, a large language model. It works on the cloud. And basically what you do is you reveal, you know, certain quantum bits of information, and then you interpret these together in a sort of neural net, and they'll then, you know, spit out, you know, what a useful insight into the future. You know, if you phrased it in the right language, people would be all over that.
Yeah, and then whack out the Hierophant and like
death by water.
It's more about change, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be amazing. I think you should lean into the shamanism more. You just have to be quite subtle about the way that you do it, you know.
Yeah. Again like the frog in water, just
exactly.
You should just add a couple of percent each week.
Yeah, or the Persian king, great king, you know, inoculating himself to poison by just having a little bit more every day. But that's a great idea. That's a great idea. Mm. Well, there's one insight then that actually shamanism is something that is really powerful, does operate in the modern world, but because we don't recognize it for what it is. It's something that people can exploit. You know, we're not quite as wise to it as perhaps we should be.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a fair amount of exploiting going on in indigenous shamanism too. I think there's plenty of examples of extremely unethical shamans.
Well, that's an interesting topic.
Yeah, well, I mean, like trying to make people sick so that you can come in and heal them and get paid, or there are plenty of Eskimo examples of trying to get sex out of people through shamanistic means. Eskimos are absolutely
like, is this the, well, is someone, this the cultural sensitivity segment of the podcast?
It is a well-known cultural behavior that when someone gets so old they're becoming a bit of a burden, even if it's, you know, you're the parents who you love, you just leave on an ice floe and wander off. I
remember reading a Jared Diamond book, The World Until Yesterday, where he talks about all the various examples of, I think he calls it elder killing. I'm not quite sure. It's quite widespread in non-state societies, and it's done in different ways. And before we get too judgmental, I think we should put forward the case that Jared Diamond makes, I think, which is that it's rational to the point of necessary in societies where you're quite close to the calorie line, right?
As in, yeah, like, if you cannot spare the calories.
If you cannot spare the calories, actually, you know, it's a different context and we therefore shouldn't judge too harshly.
And normally the victims are cool with it as well. They understand exactly what's going on and they accept it.
It's part of the culture, isn't it? Which is, you know, we perhaps should be mindful of wading into it too heavy. But
back to exploiting though. Yeah, because we aren't thinking of people as shamans, we are wide open to abuse because our mind is still the same. We're very susceptible to that. And if the only people using these patterns, these behaviors, are people knowingly doing so to take advantage of us. And if you don't have that cultural place for them that actually protects society from the misuse of these techniques, they can run rampant.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I mean, Sam Friedman would be a good example of where that has negative externalities, I think, is the economist would say.
Elizabeth Holmes.
But
also, like, you know, those Pentecostal priests who are, you know, terrible people and just absolutely rinse their congregations for loads of money. They're very much using shamanistic techniques, casting out demons and all that, speaking in tongues. And
Darren Brown is an interesting one, isn't he? Because he replicates these techniques in a way that is supposed to, I guess, expose what they are. I mean, I think he would put it as exposing. At least he would in his early work. I don't know whether he'd be slightly more reflective now, but it's interesting as to whether... Because the thing I think about Darren Brown, right, and hopefully listeners will be familiar with him, he's an English illusionist, I guess, who is quite clear that everything he does is an illusion.
Yeah, his shtick is that this is an illusion, I'm still going to rinse you with it.
The thing I've always thought about him is that he's obviously incredibly intelligent, incredibly creative, really, really sharp guy. I think, and I hope he wouldn't be offended by this, I think there is a shard of cruelty in his character, which he's aware of, and that he's very mindful of, and he keeps it under control because he's a very ethical person, I think. At least, you know, he's got a strong moral code. But I think that there must be a part of him that enjoys the process of manipulation. And the way that he's come to cope with the fact that he enjoys manipulation is precisely...
Yeah, to make it all right.
Is precisely to say, well, I'm going to use this for good. I'm going to manipulate people, but I'm going to explain that I am manipulating them. I'm going to show them how I did it. And that way, ultimately... You know, I'm a force for good in the world, which I think is very admirable. This is not a shade at Darren Brown interlude, but I think you can see it there. You can see that the slight, you know, edge that he's got in him.
Yeah, well, I mean, you wouldn't spend all that time learning those skills,
no,
if you weren't motivated quite strongly.
No,
by something.
I don't think you would, and I think that's very interesting because I think that there are some. He's a good example that there are some people who are incredibly intelligent, really very perceptive, have really, you know, they can see you coming from about 5 miles away and they put in the time to learning, you know, and honing those techniques. And I often, you know, I think this is something that many people will have thought of if they're watching Darren Brown. They're thinking, God, thank God he's a good guy.
Yeah.
because if he weren't, that would be extremely dangerous. But of course, if there's one, there are more, and that's a disturbing thought.
Yeah, although I know I always get that bit of help, hope from, like the way that all the Islamist terrorists are just really stupid, and so they're quite ineffective.
Mm.
Like, it's almost like people operating that level, you can't operate that level without having a bit of a moral compass.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you're like, intelligent enough to do that, then you can't avoid the ethical implications of your...
Yeah.
Actions.
That's what gives me a lot of hope, especially in the face of terrorism, where like anyone who wants to do that isn't going to be very good at it.
Yeah, because they're not very bright. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that is a comforting thought. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. So is he? Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, I suppose he is a sort of a shaman in a way, old Darren Brown. But of course, I wonder whether he has to enter slightly altered states in order to achieve the things that he does.
Yeah, to get into the zone, to be that on point.
Yeah, the kind of...
He must have to do something, there's some preparation.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, he's not here to ask, sadly. Maybe if he listens to this and is not too, in, you know, he's not too offended.
Yeah, that's a less controversial thing. Like if you look at fighters in UFC, they're clearly in a very different mindset when they're in the octagon than they would be day to day. Like I think in a lot of high pressure scenarios, again, like, you know, soldiers in battle, I think a lot of behaviors rely on not being our normal, chill, rational selves and actually putting our brain into a different gear.
Yeah.
And artists as well. Like I think some people just have access to slightly different ways of seeing the world.
Yeah, I think it's quite a modern thing as well to believe in a sort of rational baseline, to believe in a sort of a standard state of consciousness in which we are you know, quote unquote, rational actors. I think that's a very modern thing.
And
I think that is actually wrong. I don't think there is a rational baseline. I think there are just different states of consciousness, and some are more frequent than others in different situations. But I don't think that they're...
And so power comes from being able to switch them at will, almost.
Well,
or understand how to use them.
Yeah, it certainly does, doesn't it? I mean, you do. I mean, successful people are able to switch mindsets quite quickly, aren't they? I mean, that is the mark of an effective person, is that you're able to, you know, to use the vernacular, get in the zone. If you can't get in the zone, you're not effective. I always remember, you know, I used to play tennis quite a lot at school. And I was quite good. I was quite technically proficient at tennis. I was on the first team. And, you know, we did win a lot of our matches. But I was always very prey to the old choking in the high-pressure scenarios. And it didn't happen all the time, you know. But when it did, it really did. And I've always been a little bit vulnerable to that sort of, you know, negative thought process going down the rabbit hole and blah 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 blah. And it's something I recognize about myself, but I still don't think I can do about it. I still, even though I know about it, you know, I've recognized it, I can see it coming, I can stand back and analyze it happening. I can't stop it. And you know, so that's an example of where I'm not able to switch.
I remember I was watching the Wimbledon final the other day between Sinner and the Spaniard, and there was a break between games and they're both sitting down. The commentator was like, oh yeah, he'll be thinking back to their last match, you know, 2 months ago, and that'll be going through his head. And I was like, I can absolutely guarantee you that is not going through his head right now. Like, you don't get to that level dwelling in the middle of a game on something that happened 2 months ago. No, he is locked into this game. There is nothing else in his mind.
I see. I would be thinking back on 2 months ago, which is why I'm not
in the world of football.
Exactly. I often think about that with sports stars. I mean, the ability to shut out the pressure and the thought of what if, and perform. I mean, that is astonishing, isn't it? I mean, I think that's in a way more impressive than the physical attributes.
Yeah, I mean, after a certain point, like the physical attributes are a given. Like, there are loads of people who have that body who can do those feats. It's then the mind keep you at that level or pushing a body one step further. It's not the body that's doing it, it is the mind. I think sports psychology and the winning mentality, and they call it the championship mentality in fighting.
You and I probably wouldn't be very good at the, you know, elite sporting level. Maybe you'd be quite good at shooting, actually. You're quite good at that. But there are situations where both of us would be not well equipped for that mentally. But we'd probably both be quite comfortable, you know, walking into a, I don't know, like a meeting at work. You know, I don't find that intimidating, like, at all, because I'm very confident in being able to switch on the ability to, you know, talk to people and appear credible. keep your thoughts to yourselves, listeners. I'm very happy doing that. It doesn't faze me at all. I don't get nervous about it. I don't choke. I don't freeze. I don't worry about it at all. The point being, I'm not just trying to blow smoke up my own arse here. What I'm saying is that the things that we're good at, that actually we make a living off, usually will involve us switching states mentally. And the states that you're able to easily switch into, I think it will play a big part in determining what you do, you know, what you're good at.
Your life path,
Well, I think that's we've taken a pretty circuitous sort of ramble through various shamanistic issues and adjacent.
Narrowly defined shamanism to extremely broadly defined.
I think there's probably more to say about shamanism, but that's
I think so.
That's a little ramble through.
Well, we've introduced it into the stream of consciousness that is this ongoing
series.
Each episode we integrate something else into the grand plan.
You know, 20 episodes later, we might say something, you know, really quite insightful about shamanism.
But for now,
that's your lot.
Sorry.
No. If anything insightful was said, it was very much by you. Thank you for doing the reading.
the drumming.
And the drumming. I think that was my favourite part so far. On the all of this podcast is
we should crack it out more often.
I think we should. I think we should just do a segment. You know, we can start doing segments like radio shows. You know, there's the 5 minute segment of meeting the spirit guide. Let's see what he has to say on this this issue. That'd be great. Very good. Okay. Well, pleasure as always. And
till next time.
We're doing it back to back, aren't we? We're doing another one tomorrow. I mean, it won't be released tomorrow. Sorry, listeners, from when you're listening now. But we're going to record back to back. That's the plan.
Yeah. So we'll see if that makes a difference.
Yeah. Cool. Well, speak to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye.